This episode is sponsored by ByHeart. Hold on, y'all. With all this talk about making babies that we love to do, let's talk for a second about feeding those little miracles when they come. ByHeart is an infant nutrition company that started with a simple mission: make the best formula in the world. When chest feeding isn't an option, ByHeart's clinically proven easy-to-digest infant formula is there for you. Their patented protein blend gets closest to breast milk. Plus, ByHeart is made with certified clean ingredients and no soy, corn syrup, GMOs, or palm oil. And it's the only U.S.-made infant formula with globally sourced ingredients to use organic, grass-fed whole milk, not skim. ByHeart also happens to be clinically proven for easier digestion, less spit up, and softer poops versus a leading infant formula, which, trust me, you're gonna want. So tell me, you curious about ByHeart? Redeem your welcome offer at byheart.com/podcast with code QueerFam for a limited time. Additional terms and conditions apply. This episode is sponsored by Feathersnap. Okay, hold on, y'all. I have to tell you about something that my wife got us into and that my whole family is loving now. Brace yourselves. It's the Feathersnap Scout Smart Bird Feeder. Yes, I said bird feeder. This thing is so cool, and it offers a brand new way to connect with nature and learn about the birds right in your own backyard. Or if you're like us living in New York City, it's in your friend's backyard in the country, and you get to use the app connected to it to learn all the stuff. It's got this high resolution camera that connects to an app so you can check out a live stream from your feeder. You can take photos and videos of the birds that visit. You can ID the species using expert trained AI, and you can earn badges along the way. You can even, y'all, learn fun facts about hundreds of species. For example, did you know that American crows can recognize and remember people's faces? And they can even teach their young who's a friend and who's a foe? I know that now. Did you? Seriously, the Feather Snap Feeder is entertaining, it's educational, and it's just a whole bunch of fun for the whole family. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. This episode is brought to you by Yoga Sleep and BetterHelp. We're happy to have them on board making this show a possibility.
Welcome to If These Ovaries Could Talk. I'm Jamie.
I'm Robin.
And we're your hosts.
We sure are. Love is love. If you don't have to make a family by taking a traditional ride. If these ovaries could talk, you would say. How do I get the sperm through custom?
I am a lesbian.
So gay.
We need to tell our story.
It's not your nuclear family anymore. It's not just your mom and dad thing.
We're not ruining these little humans.
Not for the gay reason. Just because we stick.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Here we are. Once again.
We're struggling. Now that we got our new little intro, we can't figure out how to transition.
I
want to
say my name and I can't. I know. It's so weird.
It's already been said.
Anyway, we're here.
Wait, we got a news item, Jamie, to start things off.
Exciting stuff.
I mean, it's not really news as much as it's a listener.
A news ding. Do, 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 ding. Like that.
Okay. Yeah, so we got a little story. It's a listener email.
Yeah. Somebody wrote in response to our February 3rd episode called Stacey Ann Chin is Back. Mm-hmm. In it, Stacey Ann Chin talked about her daughter Zuri being an upstander and not a bystander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we got a cool email from a listener about it. And she said, about your episode with Stacey Ann Chin, you talked about raising white men. Wanted to encourage you. My brother, and he's a blonde ski guy, recently told me how they had a girl in their friend group who was telling about this guy she was dating who was being inappropriate or oppressing. He knew this guy, so he went and talked to him about it, told him it's unacceptable, not cool, not fun. He told him that being respectful is the way to be in their friend group. What else did he say, Jamie?
He said the guy really heard him out and visibly improved his behavior. The guy said hearing it from a man friend changed his view. It's interesting. And that he can see he was being disrespectful. My brother is not the big talking upstander guy, never been, but he has a calm way of speaking seriously to people, to the point, without fear, on eye level. It gives people a real opportunity to change. I'm so proud of him. I am a loud feminist, but I've never done something like this. So boys can be so awesome and they can improve each other. It's really great. Thanks so much. That's from Eleanor on Instagram. And just to give a little reference, we were talking about how we're nervous about raising white boys, mm-hmm, and we want them to be good. We want them to be
like good people who stop bad things from happening.
Yeah, right. And not, you know, this,
you know.
Not the turds.
Exactly.
We don't want them to be turds. We want them to be the guys that make.
We want them to be upstanders, yeah, upstanders, not bystanders. So thanks for that.
That was like good feedback. And I thought that was really cool because it's definitely something that we think about a lot.
We do.
Raising Being young men.
Gay moms raising young men.
I feel like most people raising.
Yeah. You would hope so.
I mean, we love men. I mean, we're not saying we don't love men.
We're not.
You know.
We're not man bashers.
No,
like people like to believe. I like men.
We did get feedback on what we got a troll who told us like all lesbians were man bashers. Yeah. And that's why we couldn't raise children.
That's why we can't raise children. It doesn't even go together.
It was like some of these trolls though are so uneducated. I'm just like, I don't even understand what you're saying.
Keep coming, trolls.
Somebody wrote a comment on it was about like this past episode with Renee.
Oh yeah,
something about. I believe whoever has the DNA is the real parent. Yeah, and I was like, what are you even talking about? So adopted parents aren't parents? Like, they're just so dumb.
No, and one person said, I believe the only people who can really be parents are the ones who conceived.
And I was like, what?
Well, everybody conceived. What are you talking about? Everybody's conceived. Every single person in this world was conceived. So what are you talking about?
JB and I have like back and forths for like, do we say something? And then like sometimes I'll wait. And then all of a sudden I'll be like, no, I'm saying something.
Yeah. After that third margarita.
I'm saying something.
No, it's generally I'll look and I'll be like, ah, shit, Robin responded. Or then vice versa. She'll look and be like, ah, shit. Jamie got into it. You just can't.
I think it's funny.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I don't take any of it personally.
It's not funny, though. Well, like, you never know.
What's not funny? They're going to drive by our house? I mean, then, come on.
I don't know.
I feel like there's way more high-profile LGBTQ people they're going after than us. They're definitely not finding us. These people, most of them are like 80. And I'm like, the one lady who was like, I'm not gay. I'm 80 and I'm single. And I wrote back to her. I don't need this post. Yeah, I don't need this post. And I wrote back to her. I was like, maybe you should give it a whirl.
I know, Robin. Aye.
It's fun. I don't care.
No, it's just people just who've never met a gay person, I suppose. And so this is what we're doing. We're introducing the guy to everyone's lives.
Gay families.
Gay families are so cool.
Should we introduce our next guest?
Oh my gosh.
By the way, he's like a prominent guy, and we're going to introduce him talking like this right now.
Jeez, I forgot who this episode is. He's like, who are these dumb women? Okay.
He was like, it seemed like such a powerful and smart conversation.
It was actually an amazing conversation. And so we need to get to the episode because you guys need to hear what this guy has to say. Anyway, his name is Richie Jackson.
He's the producer behind Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song on Broadway, plus Emmy and Golden Globe nominated TV shows such as Nurse Jackie.
No big deal. Just Nurse Jackie. I was just talking with Anne about how good that
show
is.
I love that show, Nurse Jackie.
Freaking love that show.
But he wrote a new book called Gay Like Me, A Father Writes to His Son.
Really amazing book. It was chosen by Town and Country as one of the most anticipated books of the year. It was named an LGBTQ book that'll change the literary landscape in 2020 by
our friend, Oprah.
Oprah. She's going to be our friend. Yeah, she's going to be our BFF because our book's about to be that too.
And we actually got to talk to him. Can you believe he came on our show?
I can't. He hoodwinked. He's huge. He's big. This book is amazing.
Loved it.
And we do have to give you a little bit of a trigger warning because it does cover one little sensitive topic.
Yeah, the first 15 minutes of the interview, we're talking about losing a child at birth. So if that's an issue for you, you can skip forward to after 15 minutes.
But it's a beautiful story.
He's coming from healing too. So
I feel like I want him to be my dad.
I know.
My other dad.
My brother. A friend, uncle, all those things.
He's a good guy. He's a good hugger, too. Everybody should get a hug from Richie Jackson.
Well, let's listen to the interview,
shall we? Okay. Hi, Richie Jackson.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh my God. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, more importantly, thank you for coming.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
We are so excited to have you.
We have both been just talking back and forth about your book, like since your publisher sent it. So we've just been like, and he said this. Did you read that?
Did you read this part?
And I was like, yes, I have that noted.
Did you get the part where he said this? Yeah. So we're very excited to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Your book is called Gay Like Me, A Father Writes to His Son.
We're going to talk a lot about that.
But before we get into that, we...
Putting you on the spot.
...need to hear your 30-second elevator pitch. I'm going to time you. I'm getting my timer up right now. I'm
trying to remember my haftorah for my mitzvah. Okay.
All right. Okay. On your mark. Get set. Go.
My name is Richie Jackson, and I am married to my husband, Jordan Roth. We've been together for 17 years, married since 2012. We have two children. Our older son is 18 and our younger son is 3.5. Oh. And both of our sons were born through surrogacy.
Well, look at that. You still have 10 seconds. Anything else you want
to
say?
I'd like to do a tap dance number and sing.
Can you sing?
That would be our first follow-up question. No,
because you're in the Broadway world. I was going to ask
you. I know, but I'm not on the stage.
Yes, you're behind the scenes.
I'm comfortably off stage.
All right, well, so let's get into the makeup of your family.
Like, yes.
18 and 3.
Yes.
I mean,
that's a...
Well, you know, my husband and I joke that we do one at a time, make sure we get it right. we think everybody who does 2 at a time and 3 at a time is crazy.
You're not wrong.
When our older son was graduating high school and still talking to us and enjoyed being with us, we thought, you know what? We're going to do this again. And so we dived right back in.
That's amazing. Amazing. So talk to us about the making of your first son.
So our older son, Jackson, I had from a previous relationship, the actor B.D. Wong and I.
Oh. Which, by the way, again, we're going to name check your book the whole night. At first, I thought, I was like, oh, we're not going to really know who B.D.
We
is.
We thought it was
like,
initials.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah. This is like some secret initial he's not going to tell. So, and then all of a sudden, like later, I was like, B.D. Wong?
It's B.D. Wong. Robin came to me, she was, it's B.D. Wong. It's B.D. Wong.
It's B.D. Wong.
Like, you know, like Law and Order B.D. Wong.
What I think's funny is I changed almost all the names in the book except B.D. Wong. B.D. Wong.
But he's okay with that, right?
Well, we'll find out.
Uh-oh.
So far, no lawyer has showed up.
He's in the entertainment world.
He'll be thrilled.
Yeah.
So this was in probably 1998, 99, we were talking about starting a family.
That was a while ago.
It was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I had always wanted to be a father. That was the single drive of my life. The ambition of my life has been to be a parent. And I remember very clearly one day sitting on the deck of a house on Fire Island, and we had just had a big family reunion with BD's family, and BD said, you know, our parents are getting older and our nieces and nephews are getting older. And if we're going to do this and if they're going to be part of our child's life, we have to do it now. And then we read this article in the New York Times about a surrogacy agency for gay people called Growing Generations. So we spoke to them and they said to us, you know, the really great way to do surrogacy is if one of you had a sibling, a sister who would donate her eggs, then the baby would be genetically both of yours.
It's the gay dream.
It is. And, you know, they said a lot of siblings say no.
Yeah, well, because, you know, some people have things wrapped around that.
Yeah.
We just had our first guest. It was two kids.
Sisters.
Two sisters who their parents did that. It was two moms, and it was like the brother of the one mom and then the other mom.
We interviewed
the
kids.
The kids are not gay. The parents are
No,
gay.
Just yeah. Like, yeah. And but that's the first time in all of our interviews, 60-some interviews, that we had somebody come forward with that. And then I saw it in your book, and I was like, oh, another one.
It's not as common as you think.
It's interesting because if you look at our son from cheek up, he looks like BD, and from his nose down, he looks like me.
That's the dream.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. That is the dream.
It was really, we didn't know anybody who had gone through surrogacy. We didn't know anything about it. We asked my sister and she said yes immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the one thing we were recommended is to have a carrier, not to have person whose egg you're using carry the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So we set out with Growing Generations to find a carrier. Back then in 2000, surrogacy in New York State was not, paid surrogacy was not legal. Shamefully, it's still not legal now.
Yep.
So when we had our second child, we had to leave the state again. But back in 2000, there was one judge in all of America that would put same-sex couples on the birth certificate.
Oh, really?
And there was this procedure you would go through where you would get a pre-birth judgment, and he would deem the parents, the intended parents, the gay parents, and he would make a decree, and those two people would have their names on the birth certificate. And back then, it was very important.
Yeah.
Because we had no laws protecting us.
No.
No marriage
even.
No, right. So we had to have our baby in California, and we found a carrier.
And the judge that would do that was in California?
Yes.
How did you even find that information? Because back then it wasn't like as prevalent.
Growing Generations knew, the surrogacy agency knew all of that.
We actually know Growing Generations. Yeah, we interviewed Kim Bergman.
Yeah. Right. So back then, the people who ran it were the founders. Mm-hmm. And they knew all the laws. And even, you know, one of the things about using an agency is they're going to know what states you can do it in. It's a bit of hopscotch when you have when you're a same-sex couple having a baby, because you can't have the baby everywhere in America.
Right.
So you have to know what states you could do that in.
So scary.
It is.
Such a and in 18 years, how much it has changed, but yet how much still has to change.
Yeah, you know, it has changed that there are more states, but New York State hasn't changed at all.
No.
Which is crazy.
Right. And back in 2000, BD and I were expecting identical twins. And our carrier was in Modesto. We were in New York. We were so far away from her because, again, not allowed to do this where we live.
Yep.
So it was a lot of phone calls. Mm-hmm. We did not have the money to go to the doctor's appointments with her. We had to hear about the doctor's appointments from her, and we'd check in with the doctor, and he didn't know what to make of the fact that he was talking to two men who's having this baby.
It was all very new and different. Yeah.
And the babies came 3 months premature.
That's very.
And Jackson's brother, Boaz, our firstborn son, died after an hour of being born. And Jackson was in intensive care for 3 months. I bring it up to mention we left the best medical care in the world in New York because we were prevented from having our family here and still are. So I fly out to Modesto. The doctor says, your second son will probably die and we can't take care of him. We don't have the level NICU unit you need to take care of him. So we airlifted him to San Francisco. The very first moments of my being a parent were in trauma. And Jackson had a surgery when he was 8 days old and 2 pounds.
So what was the surgery for?
He had something called NEC, N-E-C, which was a perforated bowel. And so he had to have surgery.
Oh. Wow. And I imagine you're grieving the loss of your first son, the other baby.
Yeah. So, this was a big lesson for me, and I didn't learn it quite at the right time. We were so busy taking care of Jackson, and we were so worried, and there was so much to do, and he was so fragile. Mm-hmm. We couldn't touch him or hold him for probably a month or a month and a half. I didn't realize you could feel lucky that one survived and also mourn at the same time. Mm. I think we didn't mourn properly at the time because we were, and because our well-intentioned family friends were like, you're lucky, you're lucky, you're lucky.
Right, yeah, right.
And I didn't know I could be lucky and sad. That was years of therapy later. Yeah.
I feel like that's in a lot of death. Like there's so many people around and there's so many activities and so much happening that you can't grieve until people leave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, grief, as I talk about in my book, is a manageable disease. It doesn't really go away. To this day, every once in a while, BD and I will text each other, I'm having a Boaz moment. And it was like, we'll pass twins in a playground. Something will happen that will bring that back to us.
Wow. Yeah. Do you think that if you had been here for the delivery that maybe Boaz would have made it?
I don't know medically if that's true. I do know that we would have had doctors who probably would have understood that there was twin-to-twin transfusion happening, which is the lining between the identical twins tore. And I think that would have been identified earlier. Whether that would have changed anything, I don't know.
Right, but it's something that might run through your head for the the rest of your life.
Almost like you can't think that way because then you would be in a what-if tailspin.
Right.
Wow, that I can't even imagine. 3 months, did you have to move out there as well?
And also use up all your paternity leave.
Yeah.
Right.
So
Before you even get home.
Right. So what happened was we were there together for several weeks and BD was in the middle of making a movie. So he kept having to run down to LA to do a day here, a day there. And then I would go back to New York when I ran out of my leave and then we would take turns. And there was a moment where Jackson needed a blood transfusion and they would not let BD and I donate blood because the FDA regulation is gay men cannot donate blood. That was in 2000. And still today, gay men are not allowed to give blood if they weren't celibate for a year. There's no medical reason for that to be today.
No.
They know there's no good medical reason.
It's especially discriminatory. Since surrogates are able to carry for HIV positive people. So that,
right. And
how's that different?
And back then we needed to be tested to do the surrogacy. So they knew we were not HIV positive. Now, you know, because of PrEP and all the drugs that are getting people's viral load so low, it wouldn't be able to be transferred to a baby.
Right.
So it is still discriminatory.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I was sitting in this hospital seething that my baby, just a few weeks old, was confronting homophobia and bigotry right at the beginning of his life. Right.
Well, I just imagine you must have felt so helpless.
Yeah.
I was helpless in an already helpless situation.
Yeah.
I had one baby who just died, one who's near death, and I was made to feel even more helpless. I pledged to take care of this baby. That was what you do as a parent.
Yeah.
And I was told I couldn't.
Hey, Jamie, did you know that sleep deprivation is something that all parents know too well?
Yes.
Have you heard of this? All I know is that restorative sleep is crucial to overall health, yet it's so elusive.
Oh, it's so hard to get. Tell me about it. I rarely get an uninterrupted night's sleep. Rarely. But that's why I love Yoga Sleep. Yoga Sleep has been making products for sleep for over 50 years. Did you know that?
I did.
And they invented the Dome, which I love.
Love
it's the very first white noise machine. Listen, they know how to make trusted products that actually work. And you know, white noise is a natural approach to better sleep and relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
Yoga Sleep also, they make sound machines for home, travel, and baby. I have them all.
Oh, I know. I have them all too. Well, my daughter took the Dome, and of course she leaves it on all the time. So I hear it down the hallway. Like,
of course.
But
such a nice sound. Oh,
I love it. It's so soothing.
Nice.
I looked them up after I bought them because I was so intrigued by it. And I learned that Yoga Sleep started back in 62 when their founder invented the original sound conditioner. It had a real fan inside.
And I think it still does.
Yeah. And it's been like beloved by millions ever since.
So good.
And their products, this is one of my favorite parts about Yoga Sleep. Their products are backed by a 101 night promise, meaning basically, you're trying them risk-free.
101 nights.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
I did not know that. But I have no need to return mine, so
no,
I'm good.
It's of course not.
Helping my whole family sleep, since we basically all end up in the same bed at some point during the night. We all love it. Even the dog loves it.
Well, we have a deal for our listeners. You can go to yogasleep.com/OCT, and you're going to save an exclusive 20% off a sound machine for natural sleep for the whole family.
Okay, you heard it here, folks. That's yogasleep.com/OCT to get 20% off. yogasleep.com/OCT.
And then hide it from your children because they will steal it because they will love it so much.
After the babies were born prematurely, what happened with the surrogate? Did she stick around a little bit?
She was in the hospital in Modesto for a few days, and she asked me to go buy a pump because she wanted to pump her breast milk.
Oh, that's good.
And Modesto is several hours from San Francisco. She would drive the breast milk to the hospital.
That's incredible.
And it would be frozen for him.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's
great. So you had a stockpile by the time you...
So his first few weeks of... he didn't use breast milk for a long time. And then I remember the very first tiny little test tube of breast milk that he ate once his bowel problem was fixed. And it was the breast milk from the freezer.
How did they even feed him before that? Was it just intravenous?
Intravenous, yeah. So one moment, I'll never forget, we came into the hospital to see him one morning, and the doctor ran out into the hall and say, not in his brain, because he had been in the hospital so long, they couldn't use the veins in his arms and legs anymore. So they put it in his head. And she wanted us to know before we saw him that it wasn't in his brain.
Holy cow.
Ugh. Yeah. So this is the trauma of starting parenting. And to this day, I have not recovered from that.
Mm.
I know that I hug him too long every time I hug him.
You say
I
this know in that your book,
I
yeah.
just... have the feeling he could slip away any moment. And I talk about in the book, there are moments now, he's in college, where every once in a while we'll be sitting at dinner and he'll take my hand. And I don't move because I don't want him to realize he's now holding my hand.
Yeah.
And it is as grounded and as whole as I ever feel.
Yeah.
Was there ever a point where you felt like he was less fragile? Because I imagine you took a tiny baby home.
Right. We took a 4-pound, 4-ounce baby home on an oxygen machine. He was on oxygen for months after we got him home. And, you know, I felt like we limped home.
Yeah.
That we didn't really have a triumphant getting home. I don't know if you've had this experience parenting, but I'm always a little behind his development. Like he's always been ready for things more than I think he's ready. And that has nothing to do with necessarily his prematurity. It's just he'll do something and I'll be like, oh, we're there now. I didn't realize.
I think we all do that. Like,
You're going outside by yourself.
Your kid does his shoes. I was like, why are we still doing the shoes?
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think there were, you know, definitely a moment where I was like, oh, wow, he's way more resilient than I thought. But the remnants of the prematurity, some of his motor skills and he wears glasses that are totally a remnant of the prematurity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did the two of you handle it? Because it's such a big stress on a relationship.
BG and I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have heard that 90% of couples that lose a child break up. Mm. And it was described to me as you're each in a lifeboat, separate lifeboats, and you want to help each other. You just have no idea how to. Mm. What I think happened to us is it just unearthed a lot of things that were wrong anyway, and they might have come to the surface later. It wasn't necessarily this that broke us up, but it did unearth some issues that we had that just we had to deal with.
I'm sure it certainly didn't help.
No, you know, I was very sad for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
From the death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
And I imagine
there's like dashed expectations and from what Jackson lost.
Yeah.
He lost the brother.
I want to ask you that. Does he notice the loss? Is there anything?
When he was younger, he talked about it more. Somebody the other day asked me.
Because you said they were identical, right?
They were identical twins. The last time he talked about it was on the day before his bar mitzvah. He asked, had Boaz lived, would they have been bar mitzvahed together? Mm. He doesn't talk about it as much as he used to.
Mm. Yeah, because I just wonder if there's that, you know how there's that just twin sensibility thing? Yeah.
I wonder if he'll notice it later and have this, but it doesn't come up as much as it used to.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, he's got a strong guardian angel up there.
He does.
Wow, so that's a lot.
Yes.
Are you happy you have me now?
Yes, actually.
But, you know, our son is in college and he's happy and he's engaged in the world and he's a really special person and he's a miracle. And BD's married and happy. And I am, you know, obviously married and happy. So I think it all.
Jordan's going to be listening going, you could have said that faster.
Yeah. Life goes on.
Yeah, there's no alternative really.
You
know, part of how we raise our children is to have resilience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want them to ignore the sad parts like I did. Mm-hmm. And part of what Jordan taught me when I met him was life can be great, but it also is complicated and don't smooth over the complications. Don't edit them out.
Mm. That's a hard thing to do.
It is.
How was it defining, like, so, I mean, how old, like, how was it defining, like, two separate households?
Yeah. So this is, you know,
Jackson,
we were very specific on how we handled our breakup and then also the addition of Jordan to our family.
You were the first one to remarry?
Yeah. I was the first one to get into a long-term serious relationship.
How old was Jackson when you officially separated?
He was 2, and I met Jordan when he was 3.
Okay.
Oh.
Way too early, but if you meet Jordan Roth, you do not say, you know, this is the wrong time.
Can you see if we're still single in a year?
That never works. So BD and I didn't ever use the word custody because that seemed, I mean, one of the benefits of the discriminatory law back then of us not being allowed to be married is we didn't have a lawyer or a judge tell us what our separation agreement had to be. We made it up by ourselves.
It wasn't War of the Roses.
We had no war. We didn't have War of the Roses. We didn't have anybody telling us what to do. It was the two of us. We didn't use the word custody because that felt like you don't own a child. And we didn't want one of us to feel like we never used the word primary. Parent, we got a credit card that we called the Jackson card, And we just always used it for anything we spent money on him for. We've never had a financial conversation. And this was back when
so you just split the bill.
Split the bill, no questions asked. And we had no money. I mean, it wasn't, we just avoided money conversations by doing that.
So smart. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, we did this well. When Jordan joined the family, we did not use the word step-parent. We didn't make any delineation that he was anything but a full parent. So all these words, these loaded words that cause bad feelings, we dispensed with. And the biggest problem was the schedule, the switching from, Jackson hated it.
Yeah.
And
BD was in New York also.
BD was in New York.
The switching from home to home.
He hated it and always hated it.
Just because he wanted to be in one particular place?
You know, had we had the wherewithal back then, we might have, although I couldn't imagine how this would work, is that whole bird nesting. Have you heard about that?
No.
Where you leave the kids in the original home and you switch out.
Yeah.
So the kids always are staying in their home.
Yeah.
The issue is you need three homes.
Yeah.
So that you have to have a certain amount of money for that.
A lot of money.
Yeah. Also, you're still stuck.
Yeah.
In some ways, living with your ex because
in their shared space.
Yeah.
That's the part that always weirds me out. It's like you're going to still be annoyed, but they left the cupboard open.
That's what I'm saying. You're still stuck in all those things that bothered you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't have necessarily worked for us, but the burden of the separation, the schedule was not, you know, it wasn't only that I missed him every weekend because the way we did it is he lived with us Monday through Friday. And he was with BD on the weekends because the split weeks and the one day here, one day, it was just too much for him.
Mm-hmm. I know someone else who did that so that one parent had like school and the consistency and then the other parent had weekends.
That's what we did. We wanted him to go to school from the same desk every day and come back to do homework. And what we really started was on handoff days, BD would come to our house for dinner.
Oh.
And then they'd leave. And then it wasn't until Jackson was 13 or 14 and says, are you doing that for me? Because I don't need to see you all together. And so then we stopped.
But I wonder if it did have an impact for when he was little. I would imagine it did.
Yeah, he would never admit it, though.
No, of course not.
He will later when he has kids.
Well, it will still be interesting to see.
And is he close with BD's new partner?
I think, you know, because he came so much later, I think he's a, you know, like a good friend and not a parental figure.
Jordan, like you call in the book, he calls him Daddy Jordan?
Yeah. So years ago on his own, he just started calling Jordan Daddy, which I thought was real. It sounds very Southern.
Yeah.
Calls your daddy?
He switched it to Daddy Jordan, and that's what it's been.
And are you?
I'm Daddy. You know, we kind of changed things when our baby was born, but with Jackson, BD's dad, I'm Daddy, and Jordan is Daddy Jordan. Mm-hmm.
Levi, is he going to call you two different things? He calls you different things. Well, that's not confusing at all.
I know. Well, you know, finally, Jackson just calls us by our first name. So I thought, what the heck? He calls me Dada and Jordan Daddy.
Ah.
I mean, I feel like we talk about this regularly. It's something that comes up. But I was really like, my kids are going to call me Mom, and my kids call me Mama. And I, like, whether I like it or not. And at first I was like, stop. It sounded like Big Mama. But I was like, but then I was kind of like, all right, I like it.
I know. Our son all on his own. I was dad and Jordan was Daddy. And Levi just started calling me Dada. And I think it's adorable.
Yeah.
But do you do what we do and send a little note to every new teacher with the key? You know, we send a little. So,
what do you send?
Well, we send a little note every year to say, okay, when Levi says Dada, he means Richie. And when he says Daddy, he means Jordan. And it's very specific.
That's so nice of you. I don't take that time for the teachers.
My kids correct everyone. They're always like, no, Mom.
Yeah.
And I heard another kid ask my kids this weekend, would you call them something different? And I was just like standing behind them watching the whole conversation. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah. He was like, she's Mommy. She's Mom. And it was like, it was so fascinating.
My daughter just did that too on the street with one of her little playmates. She said, which one is this? Which one is this, Mom? What do you call this one? She goes, that's Mama. Oh, it's so hard to explain because I have two moms. You know, like as all six-year-olds can get exasperated. But no, I don't send a key. We should do that.
It's a good idea.
Because the teacher is always asking me, like the day we our son is in daycare, and she's always asking me, which one are you? What does he call you?
Well, because, you know, they do tell stories, right?
Yeah.
They tell story. They talk about you at school.
Yeah.
And they're very specific as to who. So we want the teacher to know.
That's
and
a good
should
idea.
They ever say call, you know, they want someone called, that it would be good that the teacher knew who.
Yeah, that's true. What's because so, if, oh,
I was just
going to
say, what's so
thoughtful.
Funny is like, I don't even care. I'm like, they just call whoever picks up the phone. And I'm like, it's usually me. Mary doesn't pick up. She never, like, by the way, never picks up her phone. I'm like, why do we have a phone for you? Because it's never, the ringer's not ever on.
You're so,
ever.
You're super thoughtful. That's,
it really is.
It's really nice of you. People ask me and I tell them, I'm mama, she's mommy. They never remember though. And then
I don't
say,
remember
shorter?
Jamie's. I don't, I mean, and we've been doing this podcast
about?
For
is
2 years.
Is it just me? Is it just me? Is
no,
it
I don't remember anybody's.
I'm shorter mom, shorter word.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, that's good. All right, little mnemonic
right?
device.
You're still
can
not
can I just tell you
I
why Jackson never wanted a mom?
Yes.
It was because when he started having play dates with other children, and he's like, he'd come home and say, those mothers are so strict. And it's like, I'm so glad I don't have that.
That's hilarious.
Jamie, oh my God, we have got to talk about BetterHelp.
Oh, you finally signed up.
No. No, but I did sign up my lacrosse mom friend, Natalie.
What's wrong with you?
I'm okay. Helping people.
Okay, and how is she liking it?
Well, number one, she loves the convenience of it. She signed up on her phone right there on the field, mm-hmm. and she was matched with her own licensed professional therapist by the time she got home.
Yep.
Piece mm-hmm. of cake.
I know. I love it. I'm telling you, it's great. I schedule my weekly video sessions, but you can also do phone if you don't have video.
Natalie does phone.
Yeah, right. See, and it's you know, it's for everybody. And I never have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room like you do have to do with mm-hmm. like traditional therapy. I mean, and that is always so awkward sitting in that waiting room.
I mean, I think that's what Natalie loves too.
Yeah.
And my wife, Mary. I mean, listen.
Everybody
people,
you know.
And my sister. All these people that I've signed up for BetterHelp therapy. But what I love about it is that it's more affordable because I do the bills than
right.
traditional offline counseling, and there's financial aid is available.
Yeah, I know. You should do it. You should just sign up already.
Listen, I signed up Natalie for
you need
for
help.
It. I'm feeling good about that.
Robin, I'm telling you, the thing is, it's legit. It's not a crisis line. Mm-hmm. It's not self-help, you know, so you shouldn't be so afraid of this. It's professional counseling done securely online. It's your time,
I'm not
Robin.
Afraid of it. That's why I signed Natalie up for it.
God.
Listen, guys, you heard it here, folks. Be like my friend Natalie. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today, mm-hmm. in all seriousness. Just visit betterhelp.com/OCT. That's better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 700,000 people, 700,001 now that Natalie joined, that are people that are taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
Yeah, we also have a special offer for If These Ovaries Could Talk listeners. You'll get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/OCT. That's H-E-L-P.
I should be getting commission from them.
You
I'm
should just
you,
be
I love
signing
them so
up.
Much.
What is wrong with you?
I'm so good.
Problems.
I want to talk about your book.
Okay,
yes,
great.
Because
I'd love to.
It's so good.
I just wanted to give our listeners some insight into the book. It's you wrote this to your son,
right? So our oldest son Jackson, when he was 15, told Jordan and I he was gay, and I was elated. I wanted him to be gay. I mm-hmm. had hoped he was gay. In fact, when we were pregnant, I kept saying, you know, I really want to raise a gay child. And he said, Daddy, being gay is not a big deal. My generation doesn't think it's a big deal.
Right.
And I thought, oh no, being gay is a really big deal. And I started to think about all the things I'd need to share with him about what it means to be a gay man. And then Donald Trump was elected and brought with him to Washington Mike Pence. They are more of a threat to our son than ISIS and North Korea. They have declared war on the LGBTQ community. So now I had to warn him what it takes to be a gay man in America, just as he's about to leave our home to go to college. Mm-hmm. And that's why I sat down to write the book.
You just right. literally hit five of the things that we want to talk about.
Okay,
so
good night,
that.
Everybody. Thank you for,
thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You come at this with such a different experience than your... Robin was bringing this up to me earlier, and I'll let Robin say it. The whole divide that happens between these young kids coming out today versus somebody who came out
It's the rainbows.
Ago.
The rainbows have yeah. ruined us.
Yeah.
I just can't well, stand
like
those they, rainbows.
Like the gay bars are like almost gone.
There are no gay
bars. By the way, you mentioned Uncle Charlie's. I was like, Uncle Charlie's.
Oh, I miss Uncle Charlie's. But, I think there's like one lesbian bar left
yeah.
in the city.
Henrietta's yeah. is still open.
Henrietta's is still there.
Is there one in Brooklyn?
The Cubby Hole's still there.
Cubby Hole's there. Meow Mix is gone.
You know, there are more gay friendly places than gay places now. Yes. And that's a real loss.
Well, Mary We're calls them neighborhood bars.
Yeah. Well, Robin, you say this a lot too. It's like all the kids just go hang out now. Like it doesn't matter what you are. Is it you who says it or is it my wife who says it?
Well, because they don't need to. How sad is that? Because they don't need to find, like you mentioned this in the book too. We're just going to basically be your parents. We're like, let's mentioned this in the book. But like they, like we, I remember like, and I make this joke, but I really mean it, like trying to bring up like softball or Melissa Etheridge or some kind of something to just be like a nod and a wink. Like, are you gay?
Are
we
on
the same
us?
Team? Because you couldn't just open an app.
Right.
And like they have, like, because of that, they don't need those experiences.
I think they do.
I mean, I'm using the wrong word then.
Right.
They're not having them.
They're not
cognizant of.
But you know what the parallel I think is I think of the millennials who are, I had no money, I came out of college. I think I had $100 in my bank account. I had no safety net, no parents could help me. And me and my best friend from college lived in deep in Brooklyn when no one was living in Brooklyn, eating ramen noodles, drinking beer in the apartment because we couldn't afford to drink once we got to the bar. And the millennials are missing that. They're missing, like, and I mean that, like they need that. Like, that's where I grew. That's where I became an adult.
Well, I think it also, community is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. All these kids who say I'm not straight or gay. I'm
queer.
Yeah. Or I'm, you know, I'm open. All those words to describe feelings are great, but where's the word us? I'm part of this community. That is really important. And they're not getting these experiences of being in the majority in anywhere. In the gay bars is where I found that. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to have a sense of community because, and not only to understand the power of being gay, the power of otherness, and how being gay is all about creativity and exuberance and has extraordinary people in our community, but also there is a war being waged on us and we have to fight back. This young community has to do what we do, did act up and fight back.
Right.
And so I want to make sure that all of their openness is still making them part of our community to fight back.
Right. You talk about your identity as a gay man in a unique way that I have not really heard spoken much at all. And I just want to read what you wrote. You say being gay is the most important thing about me. I have heard all the damaging delusions. Gay doesn't define me. Gay is just a part of me. I just happen to be gay. These are dismissals, rendering gay as incidental, merely matter of fact. Merely matter of fucked.
Maybe.
Fact. Sometimes.
Maybe
it is.
Definitely matter of fucked.
It's just, and then you go on and explain how being gay is just the most important part of your identity. And I have never heard anybody say that. And
well,
I find it really interesting. So please.
I think partly because we're taught to diminish ourselves mm-hmm. all the time. So we've gotten to this place where our liberation to ourselves feels like saying, well, being gay is not a big deal. That seems to be the best possible place we can be. And I don't want to celebrate being gay just one day at the end of June. Being gay is the most important thing about me. It informs everything about me in every part of my day, all day long. And I'm not going to diminish myself for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what we all go through as LGBTQ people. We're marvels. We disappoint our parents. Mm-hmm. We're at battle with our government. We're stigmatized by religions. We are bullied in our childhoods. We're erased in our classrooms. We've survived a plague. And still, we rise, come out, and say, this is me. That is the spirit of an extraordinary species of people. That's how we should be talking about ourselves. That's how we should be treating ourselves. And that's what I'm hoping to do with this book.
Right. When you put it that way,
it feels
sounds
like what,
wonderful.
Yeah, it feels like what you're saying is we can't forget our history because we are considered by some, many, I guess that's debatable, as it's more acceptable now. So we
citizens. You know, one of the things I'm finding as I go around and talk about my book is I think it's going to be harder for my son to come out in 2020 than it was for me in 1983.
But your son doesn't think that though, right?
No, he thinks it's no big deal. There are over 100 anti-LGBT bills in state legislatures. Over 30 states in all have them. There is an epidemic of transgender women, mostly women of color, being murdered.
Yeah.
The Trump administration has argued in the Supreme Court that it's okay to be fired for being gay, that gay people should be able to not have families. They're letting states that get federal funding for their foster care deny LGBTQ families to foster and adopt. There is a war going on. And as I said, I think the rainbows and the love is love has lulled us. All the visibility is a veneer. It hasn't made us safer or whole.
Mm. You talk about that a lot in your book, about how a big part of being gay is protesting and fighting. And I agree. I do believe a lot of that is lost.
Don't you think it's not just lost on gay youth, but it's like youth, like in general?
Well,
like they're not necessarily fighting the way that everyone was fighting.
Well, I think social media is an extraordinary way to get out an idea and to quickly get a group of people together. But then putting a rainbow on a tweet or an Instagram is not protesting.
Right.
When my first act as a gay person was marching to try to get the government to combat AIDS. Back when I was younger, the Pride Day was marches. They were not parades.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now it's a parade and the colors are blindingly positive.
Yeah, it's just corporations,
right.
Advertisement.
Yes.
And you do say it is wonderful to see that.
Last June, the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, there were two events. There was a queer march in the morning that was more fists than flags, and there was angry chants, and there was a die-in. And in the afternoon was the parade and corporations mm-hmm. and lots of rainbows. And I think both together tell a better story than just that one parade.
And that's more broad.
Yeah.
So what would be, I'm trying to figure out how to ask this, but like what would be what you would want from your son, like for him to say or to embody that it would feel like he was coming at it from what your letter is to him?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think partly I want his liberation not to be to diminish it. Not to say when we finally get our rights, when we're finally safe, to say, well, being gay is not a big deal. I would like him to understand how important it is to be gay. It's how you love. It's how you're loved. It's how you're governed. It's how you're politicked. It dictates which states you can have a family. It dictates which laws pertain to you, which laws don't. It dictates when you can hold the person you love's hand and when you don't feel safe enough to kiss them goodbye. It's really important. And I want him to understand that, how daily important it is. I don't know about you guys, but we didn't politicize him when he was little. We wanted him to feel safe.
Right.
So we never let him know how
all the measures you took.
And how careful we had to be.
Right.
Because we wanted him not to be scared.
That was something I wanted to ask you about. You say that in the book about how you kind of sheltered him from the fact that you made sure you chose vacations that would definitely be gay friendly and welcoming right. to the family and everything.
And
you
he
did
didn't
was
notice
to
I didn't
him.
Kiss Jordan goodbye on the subway when
right.
we dropped him off at work, or that I was always looking around when we were in the supermarket and he would call out Daddy or Daddy Jordan, just because you have to be aware as a gay person in America, you have to be alert.
Yeah.
And he was not aware that we traveled everywhere with his birth certificate.
Right. Yeah.
And,
right.
you know, I will tell you, in 2016, when our baby was born, and then after Trump was elected, our lawyer called us and said, I know that your names are on the birth certificate. Now get a second parent
yes.
adoption.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to go to the Dominican in a week. And I every time going to another country, I think,
absolutely.
You know, okay, is this going to be the moment where they're like, oh, why do you have a king size bed or all that? Like, and I have that hesitation, but I mean, this is the only part I struggle with. What you're saying is like, don't you think it's good that he doesn't have that baggage?
Well, now that he's gay.
I know, but I'm saying like he doesn't have that knee jerk reaction. Like I will have on the subway still to this day, I'll think if Mary goes to hold my hand or something, I'll be like, I look around to see who's on the train. Like all those
but
things
his
are
not having that knee jerk reaction. Doesn't mean he's more safe.
Right.
I mean,
no, but he's the same unsafe, but at least he doesn't have the bad feeling in his heart at the same
right.
time.
So what I think of it a little differently, I think he doesn't have the gay guard he needs to be aware
right.
of when he has to be careful.
Right. Like you say in your book, he's going to go out into the world now as a gay man. He's going to go away to college. He's going to be in different towns and with different people who didn't grow up with the same sensibilities that he did around the LGBTQ world, who have judgments on the LGBTQ world. He's going to be having sex with men who have a lot of shame over the fact that they're gay.
Right. That's the part.
And he doesn't have that guard up. He hasn't thought that through. It was a really interesting take that I would have never thought about.
The sex part is really where I've talked a lot about with him, and I talk about in the book. When I came to New York and I was 17 and we were all experimenting with each other, I didn't know anything. And the first guy that I had sex with, before I sat up in the bed, broke up with me because he said, we shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. He was so shameful. The second guy I had sex with told me he was straight, then leaned in and kissed me. And we had this feverish a few weeks affair. And then he said to me, I'm straight. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at 17 that I couldn't save him from the horror Challenge. He had. It,
yeah, right? Homophobia.
The third guy, after intercourse one night, punched me and said, how could you have done that? Mm-hmm. He was so angry at having enjoyed sex with a man. So what I talk about in the book and what I've said to my son is you won't know where in a young person's journey they are when you have sex with them. They could be closeted. They could have been bullied. They could have been abused. They could be self-loathing. Mm-hmm. You have to take care with them and be good to them.
Because of the world we're in. Right. We are still in a heteronormative world.
Right.
And I have to say, when I was reading that chapter, my initial thought was like, oh my God, he's talking about
sex with his kid.
Gay sex with his kid. This
I
is
was
so,
the same thing.
This, you know, and then I had to check myself. And then I realized.
That's not about being gay. I don't want my parents to, well, they're dead, but I don't want them to talk about sex with me, period.
So but it's how just much like, more important is it that the fact that you're a gay man and you're talking about your sex life with your son, it's a beautiful thing, but you know, your story is actually.
It is an absolute blessing.
Right.
That I get that opportunity to give him what most of our LGBTQ youth don't get.
Right.
Less than 7% of them get an inclusive sex ed.
That was fascinating.
This struck me big. Big time.
That's nothing.
You're peeling back the curtain right now into a gay man's sex life, which I know nothing about.
Right.
I'm lesbian.
You've seen the videos.
I mean, I've seen videos.
We've all seen
videos. You know
videos.
What I mean? But like, and then when you said that about sex education, a light bulb went off in my head. Like, oh my God, no, we have no gay sex education. No.
Well, I thought it was interesting when you said that you told him like both ways when you told him about sex because you weren't sure his orientation.
Right.
I was like, what?
Right.
And
when
that's
he was
amazing.
11, we told him about all types of sex because we didn't want to give primacy of one over the other.
Right. That's amazing. But that never occurred to either one of us. Like
and
Jamie and I were both
moms.
Like, yeah, I was like, I literally was thinking about how I got a book and it was about straight sex. I mean, I think there was some mention. But
I don't know. I think I would, you know, sometimes you're with a woman, sometimes with your man.
But that was about it.
I mean, my daughter's six, so I haven't really gotten
you have
into
time.
It that far.
You know, everybody says to me, how could you talk to your son so openly about sex? And I was like, my parents are going to read this. I was much more worried about them than my son.
By the way, you revealed some stuff about the good stuff that you did back in the day.
You went in there.
I feel like you had some fun.
So you know the thing about writing a letter, and I think every parent should write a letter to their child before they set off. You don't have to have other people read it like I am.
You don't have to but, be with a publisher.
Your poor son's like, Dad.
I know. He gave me permission before I wrote it. But since it was a letter, I couldn't smooth things out. I couldn't edit things out. It would have been worthless to him if I did that. Mm. And I wanted him to know how extraordinary it is to be a gay man, but also how harrowing it can be. And you can have both exist at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to help him understand how to manage the harrowing part and take full advantage of the extraordinary part.
Well, he's got, and unlike most of us who come out as gay, he's got three, four guides who have done it and who have created beautiful lives with those identities. So, like, he's pretty
lucky.
Yeah,
he
needs to
lucky.
Take advantage of it. But
right.
What's his reaction to the book?
So I gave it to him just as he started college. So he was assigned Aeschylus and Plato, and I gave him my book, and I've been put aside until he gets his reading for college done. So I'm hoping this summer he'll take a look at it. But, you know, we have dinner. When he was in high school, we had dinner every night as a family. And so these ideas won't be necessarily all new to him. A lot of what I did as a young person and all the sex stuff will be news to him. And a lot of my experience during the AIDS epidemic will be new to him because I didn't know when the right time to talk about a plague with your child is. And so that will all, I left it for the book.
And you lived through the AIDS epidemic.
I did.
You lost a lot of friends.
Really powerful.
When I was 22, I was at a funeral every weekend. And, you know, I talk in the book about how my parents are elderly now and they go to doctor's appointments and funerals. My friends did that in our 20s.
Yeah. I grew up in San Francisco, and so they were really, our sex education in middle school was like AIDS, right. AIDS, condoms, AIDS. Condoms. These are the signs that you have HIV. You know, that was even before we said HIV, before,
right.
It was still, they didn't even know that much. But I was so scared that I had AIDS, you know, but that was my sex education was just all about AIDS. So I have this fear. You talk about the fear you have that is wrapped up in sex.
Right.
I have it too, just because it was ingrained in me as a child that sex leads to AIDS.
Right. Yeah. No, I never have sex without thinking about death, even now, even married.
That's deep.
Whew. Was Rosie O'Donnell more fun than I was?
By the way, no, she got very,
oh, yeah.
She got
yeah,
very
she places.
Like deep. She got very deep in talking about, you know, her ex who died and, right. and like all that she went through. And we both said to her that you know her life because you know her from TV. But when you hear it, when you hear someone's journey beginning to end, it's very powerful.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with the book and why I had to be so honest and vulnerable is I never wanted Jackson to think I was fully formed at any point. I didn't want him to think I knew everything. His whole life, he's known things I was good at, things I was not good at, things I was challenged by, obstacles that I've had. So I think that's the way to help a child not hide any challenges or obstacles they have. If you don't hide yours and if you don't make them feel like you're perfect so they have to be perfect, they're going to be much more accepting of their own challenges and of their own vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great lesson. I have one more thing I want to bring up. You talk about, and I love this, the power that words have, the ones you choose to use, the ones you choose to think. And you have an interesting take on the power of being openly gay, of how
right.
people saying like a person in the media is openly gay. That's an openly gay person.
Right. I dislike it immensely.
You do?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my feeling about when we read or we hear a journalist talk about maybe somebody running for president of the United States or actors or journalists who are gay, they always call them openly gay. And that to me sounds like they're saying that person is not ashamed enough. They have the audacity to be openly gay and not to be hiding it. And I think it is a wink that they think being gay is still shameful,
mm-hmm.
and they put openly in front of it to say, well, we're not using that slur first. They've said it first.
Right. Yeah. They're not in the norm. They are,
right.
like, the norm is to be hidden.
Right. That they are being way too audacious by not hiding it.
That's really interesting. It got me thinking.
Why not just say, I mean, I think they should just say gay.
Mm-hmm.
Openly is theirs. They've put it on us, and I think it's a noxious term.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much in the book that just makes you stop, think about whether you believe it to be true or not true, but to really think about it and give it another thought through.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Your book definitely made me think about gay as an identity and how much of my identity do I feel is gay. And yeah, you got me thinking.
It's a brave book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Really wonderful.
It.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
I had the best time.
Oh, good.
You guys are so great.
Tell everyone to get Gay Like Me, A Father Writes to His Son by Richie Jackson.
Richie Jackson. And where can they get the book?
The book is available wherever books are sold.
I like that answer.
As opposed to you can just get it at my house.
Come to my house.
Well, thank you so much.
This was so
wonderful.
Nice. What
everybody,
a nice way to spend time.
Great. Everybody go out and buy this book because it's a good read.
Thank you.
That was, I mean, he's, that was thought provoking, right?
Very, very. I'm really, really thinking about things.
He challenged me on a few things, not in the interview, but personally to think things through differently than what I thought.
Yeah. I was just, his takes on things were just even reading his book made me really like, wait, how do I feel about this? I've never thought about it this way.
But it was like so intimate. I love that chat. It was just so great. I feel like
he's a good guy. I can't believe he has a baby and a,
oh my God, and an 18-year-old.
Wow. His life.
I don't know. Do you feel like Richie and his husband Jordan might be the ones to invite us over for dinner? I think they might be.
I think you're just holding out hope for somebody.
Somebody invite us. Maybe it'll be his like publicist will invite us over. It doesn't have to be Richie and Jordan, although I prefer Richie and Jordan.
Somebody love me too much.
Oh God.
Somebody.
Guys, while Jamie's singing, can we keep this conversation going? Join us on social. Jamie sings there sometimes. Ovaries Talk on Twitter. Ovaries _ Talk on Insta. If These Ovaries Could Talk on Facebook, you join our community there and you can talk to other listeners. Also, you can join our community on Patreon. Patreon.com/ovariestalk for bonus content. Like maybe this week we'll put up something of you singing if people want to join.
I think I should sing for every outro.
Everyone's like, no.
I should just hum underneath you. This
one was fun. They're like, this one was fun. Don't do it again. Thank you to our sponsors, Yoga, Sleep, and BetterHelp. I mean, seriously, you're helping Jamie get better and she needs it. So thank you for helping us make this show possible. We thank you.
Thank you. Good
day.
I said good
Eggs
day.
Ovaries, good out. Day out. Bye.
If these ovaries could talk, they would say, eggs, ovaries out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.